Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on marriage when we come back. You know, marriage is a state-licensed business. It's a three-party limited general partnership between you, your spouse, and the state. And like any other state-licensed enterprise, it's regulated. It's regulated by your welfare department, the Department of Family Services, and your family court. Now, the best part about all of that is that you don't have any input into or any say-so over the marriage, divorce, dissolution, custody, alimony, child support, protective custody, or the restraining orders. But you get to pay for all of that, and if you don't pay, you go to jail. This marriage program is the most important and expensive contract that you can get involved in. It's more binding, and it's more costly than your military enlistment, a whole lot more expensive than your 30-year home mortgage, and you probably know less about that than you do your military or your house payments. About two-thirds of all marriages here in the United States end in divorce, so whether you're a husband or a wife, remember, you've got rights, privileges, and immunities to advance and protect, to defend against any breach of this marriage contract. Now, that's why I contend that you ought to know and understand the terms and conditions of that marriage contract before you marry, and you ought to write that contract instead of letting somebody else write it for you. So whether you're married or not, why don't you write for my free general law CD and let me give you some vital information about this thing of the law and this marriage contract. Just call us direct. The number is 417-273-4967. That's a four-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining, educational, informative. It's best of all, that's free. And if you're online, you can go to our website. It's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. That's an easy one to remember. georgegordon.org. Just click on the email machine and send us an email request for your free general law CD package. Again, that's georgegordon.org or call us direct, 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about this thing of marriage. Three types of marriage: patriarchal, common law, and civil law. We were taking a look here at the aspects of divorce. Divorce is a part and parcel with marriage. Looking at the restrictions on remarriage after you've been divorced, and looking at what the scripture tells you about divorce and remarriage, we found that there's one law that concerns itself or describes this thing of divorce. It's in Deuteronomy 24, verses 1 through 4. Jesus was citing from Deuteronomy 24, 1 through 4, in Matthew 5, 31, 32, in the Sermon on the Mount, which many religious people use out of context, off point, claiming that divorce is prohibited, that the law has been changed in spite of the fact that God Himself said, "I change not, and I'm the same yesterday, today, and forever." So we were analyzing this Matthew 5:31-32 and discovered that the word divorce used in verse 32 is a mistranslation from the original put away. When the King James translators translated Matthew 5:31-32, they translated it into perfect English. It makes all kinds of sense, and it's correct English, but it's bad law and it's bad Greek, because that's not what the Greek said. It's a transliteration that's incorrect, although they translated it correctly in Luke 16:18. That word divorce should have been translated put away. We found that there are six words that we needed to be concerned with. You wrote those down, didn't you? Number one was the bill of divorce, which is a document And number two was the divorce. That means it's a termination of the marriage. Number three is to put away. That's an annulment. Number four is adultery. That equals the death penalty. Fornication is punishable by 50 shekels of silver. That's a fine. And annulment is synonymous with put away, and put away with annulment. But put away is not synonymous with a divorce. So, the religious people have come to some erroneous conclusions. Conclusion number one is, divorce is adultery. That's not true. And the second error is that you can't divorce except for the cause of adultery. Oh, that's not true either. In fact, the divorce statute is very vague and ambiguous, relying upon Hammurabi's code or the ancient traditions as to what the potential cause for divorce might be. It could be lying or slandering or spending me into bankruptcy, or it could be 55 things, but it doesn't have anything to do with adultery. Because if you've got a wife that committed adultery, the penalty is death. Death creates an automatic divorce. Now, the most common type of fornication is called prostitution. Fornication. The most common type of fornication is prostitution. We see that in Exodus 22, verse 16. This is where a man has sexual relations with an unmarried woman, usually for a price. The solution is separation or marriage. However, the word also covers other forms of unlawful sexual relations. In Hebrews 12, verse 16, Esau is called a fornicator, and yet there's no record in Scripture of his buying the services of a prostitute. But Genesis 26, verse 34 does say that he married Hittite wives, and we know that it was unlawful to mix seed. We knew that miscegenation was an illegal act. Thus, it may be concluded that a marriage relationship, other than kind with kind, is classified as an unlawful marriage or fornication. This term fornication is also used in 1 Corinthians 5, verse 1, where it is reported commonly that there is fornication among you, and such fornication as is not so much as named among the Gentiles, that one should have his father's wife. So we see here that Paul uses the term fornication to describe another unlawful sexual relationship that has been forbidden in Leviticus 18, verses 7 and 8, which is incest. In Jude 1, verse 7, we read of the people of Sodom and Gomorrah who had given themselves over to fornication, going after strange flesh. This, too, is obviously a sexual transgression of the law, and yet what is on record of their sexual tendencies is homosexuality, or sodomy. We'll read that in Genesis 19, verses 4 through 8. Now, each one of these examples have one thing in common. They're unlawful sexual relationships, and therefore there is no lawful marriage contract to bind these two parties together. In other words, God did not recognize the marriage in the first place. So when Christ said that it is always right to put away or separate without divorce papers one spouse in the case of fornication, the reason should become obvious. Where there was fornication involved, there was no lawful binding marriage, no contract in the first place, therefore no need to appeal to the law to have it voided. God does not recognize relationships which are homosexual, incestual, or interracial as being lawful or constituting a binding marriage contract, even if the party should agree to be married. Prostitutes do not agree to be married before having a relationship with a John or a client. Therefore, there is no need to draw up a bill of divorcement for a condition that never existed. Now, the purpose for the Sermon on the Mount was to improve upon the law's interpretation and application. The true spirit of the law had been lost through the traditions of the elders. The Messiah made an observation. He said, "You make the law of God of no effect by your traditions." So with that context in mind, and knowing that the Messiah did not come to destroy the law, let's look at Matthew 5:31 and 32 in greater detail. These two verses are a part of his comment, where he said, "You shall not commit adultery." So the final thrust of his comment is to define adultery in relationship to the laws on divorce and remarriage. Verse 31 refers to Deuteronomy 24, verse 1, where God demanded that men give their wives a written bill of divorcement before they could lawfully put away their wives. Verse 2 allowed divorced wives to remarry after a lawful divorce. Take another look at Matthew 5:31-32, inserting a few key words in the original Greek so that we get a proper translation of the passage. Verse 31 says, "It's been said, whosoever shall put away his wife, let him give her a writing of divorcement. But I say unto you that whosoever shall put away his wife, saving for the cause of fornication, causes her to commit adultery, and whosoever shall marry her, that is divorced," meaning put away, "commits adultery." The word divorced is a mistranslation, and it should be translated correctly, put away. The law says that she commits adultery if she remarries without a written bill of divorcement. So to paraphrase verse 32, Jesus said, "But I say unto you that whosoever puts her away without divorce papers," that is, unlawfully, "causes her to commit adultery if she remarries under such conditions." So he who simply puts her out of his house without divorcing her properly with a bill of divorcement is just as liable as she is. And whosoever marries her that has been put away without divorce papers also commits adultery because he's marrying another man's wife. Christ here is condemning men who put away their wives Babylonian style, verbally, by putting them away without a bill of divorcement in the prescribed manner in Deuteronomy 24, verses 1 through 4. The whole point of Christ's commentary is to bring out a point of law that had been covered by the Pharisees in their interpretations. But their interpretation of the law was incorrect. Their interpretation of the law amounted to the traditions, not the law of God. But what about the phrase "saving for the cause of fornication"? What does that mean? Most people assume that it means that if a wife commits adultery, then it's lawful to divorce her. However, it does not say except for the cause of adultery. Remember, the penalty for adultery is death, not divorce. So what is meant by fornication? Why is it all right to put away one's spouse without a divorce in case of fornication, but without fornication there has to be a bill of divorce? Well, let's run through it and think about it for a minute. Let's suppose that a young man wants to marry a young woman, and he puts up the prescribed bride price. And he goes to the wedding ceremony, and she's represented to be a virgin. But on the wedding night, we find that her tokens are not with her, and there's no blood on the rag, no tokens, and therefore he finds that she's not a virgin. Now, he paid the bride price. He agreed to marry a virgin. She's not a virgin. There's fraud on the agreement, fraud on the contract. Fraud nullifies the contract ab initio, from the beginning. Well, if there's no contract, then there's no divorce, because divorce is the methodology by which we terminate a contract. If there was no contract from the beginning, that is, from I do, until consummation, which is penetration, then there was no contract. Therefore, annulment is in place. I remember I told you about Ted Kennedy. He got an annulment through the church. He'd been married for 25 years. That's strictly prohibited. I mean, it's probably good religion, it's probably good theology, but it's really bad law because it violates Deuteronomy 24. Now, of course, religious people don't give a rat's rectum about God or about the Bible or about the law, but I just thought that for the sake of our discussion that we ought to bring in God and the law and get it straight. And to get it straight, Ted Kennedy needed to give his ex-wife a bill of divorce, but because his church doesn't recognize divorce, he needed to get an annulment, so he paid $25,000 or more to the church, and they circumvented the law of God and gave him an annulment. Now, isn't that just real special? Now, Paul did not ban remarriage after divorce. Paul, you know the Apostle Paul, guy wrote 14 letters in the New Testament. Paul actually wrote that remarriage is not a transgression of the law in 1 Corinthians 7, verses 10 and 11. Verse 10 says, "And unto the married, let not the wife depart from her husband." Verse 11, "But, and if she depart, let her remain unmarried, or let her be reconciled to her husband, and let not the husband put away or dismiss his wife." Now, at first glance, it might appear that Paul is speaking of divorce and remarriage. However, the Greek word apostasion, away from, title deed, does not appear here. Paul isn't discussing divorce, but rather the problem of separation or the putting away. In verse 1 of this chapter, it introduces the subject matter. He says, "Now therefore, concerning the things whereof you wrote unto me, it is good for a man not to touch a woman." So the subject of this discussion is whether or not to abstain from sexual relations and marriage itself. Paul had previously taught that it is good for a man not to touch a woman, but the Corinthian church had misinterpreted that to mean that sexual relations prevented Christians from attaining a truly spiritual life. Thus, the young people were being discouraged from marrying, and some of the married couples were even separating. So here Paul corrects their error. He had told them that it was good not to marry. It is true. But not because marriage itself was a transgression of the law or a hindrance to one's personal relationship with God. Rather, it was because of two things. First, the present distress discussed in verse 26. And second, to be able to devote more time and energy to spreading the gospel in verses 32 through 35. Because in those days, just like today, a man never knew if he were going to be imprisoned or executed, and his family with him. So because of the dangerous political climate, it was a good idea not to marry if a person could bear the incontinence. Imagine how difficult it would have been for Paul to travel, as he did, if he had been married and had to support his family. It was an advantage to him and others like him to remain unmarried so long as they had the gift of continence. Now in verse 5, Paul makes it very clear that it was not right for married couples to separate or even to abstain from normal sexual relations except during times of prayer and fasting. In verse 7 through 9, Paul tells unmarried people that if they can take a life of celibacy, they may do so. But if they do not have that gift, it is better to marry than to burn with lust. Paul then turns his attention to married couples, and especially to those couples who had already separated, thinking this was the spiritual thing to do. Paul's words in verse 10 are, quote, "Let not the wife separate from her husband," unquote. Paul is saying that if the wife is separated from her husband, there are only two alternatives to her: remain agamos, unmarried, or two, be reconciled to her husband. Now remember, reconciliation to your husband after you have been separated, if you've had sexual relations, is prohibited. However, I only had that come up once. I had a couple come here to school one time, young couple, probably in their late 20s. They had married early on after high school. They were married for 5 or 6 years, and they divorced. Then, after they were divorced, they had a reconciliation, went back and remarried. Now remember, Deuteronomy 24, verse 4, strictly prohibits this remarriage to a former husband after the wife, that is, after the female, has had sexual relations with some other man. I asked the magic question, I said, young woman, after you divorced, in the interim 5 years that you were separated from your husband, did you have sexual relations or did you remarry with anybody else? And she said, no, I didn't. I said, well, then there's no problem. All you had was a separation. And the divorce is now covered by the reconciliation. But had you had sexual relations, you could not return to your first husband. Now, most people are taught that this means the wife should not divorce her husband, but if she does, she must remain single for the rest of her life, or else remarry her former husband. Well, this can't be true, because the one thing a person cannot do is to return to a previous spouse once one of the two has remarried. Now, remember, one of the two has remarried. If it's the female who remarried and had sexual relations, but not the male, because the male could have a polygamous union. He could have two or three wives. Now, the context of the above passage is referring to the problem of separation rather than divorce, which should be plain to everyone because the Greek word apostasian is not used. The word that is used is agamos, and agamos means unmarried. The way verse 11 is translated in the King James Version, most people assume it to mean, let her remain in the unmarried state. However, it's more likely that the correct translation is, let her not get married to anyone else, since she is only separated from her husband without a bill of divorce. So in other words, let the wife not separate from her husband, thinking that this is pleasing to God, but if she does or already has, she should not get married to anyone else, because she's still under contract with her original husband. Later in the same chapter, Paul does deal with the question of divorce and remarriage. He does not use the technical words for divorce and remarriage, but rather the descriptive terms, bound and loosed. To be bound by law is to be married by contract, and to be loosed by law is to be divorced. You'll see that in 1 Corinthians 7, verses 27 and 28, which reads, are you bound by law unto a wife? Seek not to be loosed from the bonds of marriage. Are you loosed from a wife? Seek not a wife. Verse 28, but if you marry, you have not sinned, and if a virgin marry, she has not sinned. Few verses are plainer than these. If you are married, do not seek a divorce. If you are divorced, do not seek a wife, because of the present distress mentioned in verse 26. This is extreme persecution from the Roman authorities. But if you do marry, you haven't sinned, and if you're a virgin, you have not sinned either. So in other words, Paul says that remarriage after a divorce is not a transgression of the law. Therefore, divorce and remarriage is not adultery. Now, divorce was entirely unknown to the courts of the common law in England until long after the latest date at which the American law diverged from the parent system. The only divorce from the bond of marriage was given by the legislative power by a private bill in each case. You'll see that in Blackstone's Commentaries, Book 1, Section 594. The in each case referred to was one of the two types of divorces. The divorce could be total or simply from bed and board put away. Obviously, earlier English law was patterned after the law in the scripture. In England, divorces were handled by ecclesiastical courts, for which there were no provisions in this country. The courts in this country probably refused to hear divorce cases until there was some statutory authority, because the state may not require anything forbidden by Christianity, but it may forbear to enact many things which Christianity requires. So says Blackstone's Commentaries, Book 1, 441, Note 3. Now, no court would want to determine what was or was not forbidden by Christianity. The jurisdiction in the United States over the status of marriage is almost entirely statutory. It's been held, however, that the Court of Chancery, by virtue of its inherent equity powers, has jurisdiction to declare marriage null on the ground of fraud, mistake, or defect of mental capacity. Blackstone says the civil law, which is partly of pagan origin, in Blackstone's Commentaries, Book 1, Section 441, since the civil law is statutory law from the pagans in its original context, is in contradistinction to the common law, the unwritten law, it is pagan in form. All right, let's stop and think here for a moment. These marriage licenses that we get and birth certificates are pagan in form. They come from Hammurabi's code and the Babylonian mystery religion. They're specifically prohibited in the Mosaic law, and they're specifically prohibited in the New Testament. Now that's the story. So in conclusion, as we have seen then, that not only did the Code of Hammurabi permit divorce and remarriage, but so does the Mosaic Law. The main difference was the legal procedure for obtaining a proper divorce in order to protect the woman involved. And we've also seen how Christ added teeth to God's law by proclaiming that he who puts away his wife without a written bill of divorce causes her to commit adultery. And finally, we have seen how the Apostle Paul also understood that remarriage after divorce is not a transgression of the law. In addition, it should be clear that the early English and American traditions and customs pertaining to divorce were based on the law of the Scripture. However, somewhere in early American history, legislative bodies began passing statutes pertaining to marriage and divorce and placed everyone into this civil law, this pagan jurisdiction, from the moment the marriage license is filled out and signed. Well, let me give you a reminder here that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review. Now, the Law Hour, an editorial review, is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and worldwide over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, please go to the homeschool page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated every week. It has our radio log, our schedule, and archives. That can be accessed through the webpage. And the Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, please call the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they don't necessarily represent the beliefs or the opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or the staff of this network or local radio station. Again, for more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at area code 417-273-4967. All right, getting back here to the subject matter of divorce. If a man be found lying with a woman married to a husband, and this is Deuteronomy 22:22, talking about the adultery statute. If a man be found lying with a woman married to a husband, then they shall both of them die, both the man that lays with the woman and the woman. So shall you put evil away from Israel. If you'll remember earlier, I said Jesus bent down and wrote 4 words in the dust. And I said, I know what he wrote. And that's because he was citing directly from Deuteronomy 22:22. He said to the woman, he said, neither do I condemn you. And that's because when he wrote in the dust, where is the man? They had already said, we took this woman in the very act of adultery. They brought her in and said, hey, what do you think we ought to do with her? But they didn't bring the man in. Christians do that to this day. Christians are hypocrites. And the Christian clergy is especially hypocritical, and they're especially discriminatory toward women. Now, women want to preach. Women want to have authority in the church. They want to be preachers and priests, which is strictly prohibited in the Scripture. And the men, that is the priests, they say, okay, you women, come on in, be preachers. Go ahead, break the law. We'll help you. On the other hand, where women have particular rights guaranteed under the law, these very same men, they'll call Bill Clinton a stud and Monica Lewinsky a tramp, when in fact both Bill Clinton and Monica should have been taken out and stoned to death. Together, the condemnation of women without the equal condemnation of the guilty man is a crime, and it ought to be treated as such. Now, in Jeremiah 3, verse 14, we read, turn, O backsliding children, saith the Eternal, for I am married unto you, and I will take you one of a city and two of a family, and I will bring you to Zion. In Jeremiah 3, verse 14, God said, I'm married to you. In Jeremiah 3, verse 8, he said, and I saw when for all of the causes whereby backsliding Israel committed adultery, I had put her away and given her a bill of divorce, and yet her treacherous sister Judah feared not, but went and played the harlot also. Here we see that God himself married to these two seeming women. It's an analogy that he was married to two wives, two women at the same time, Judah and Israel. And he said, I gave Israel a bill of divorce. Later, Judah went and played the harlot and then turned around and killed her husband. Hey, Jesus is free to marry. He's got one wife killed him and the other wife's divorced. In fact, he says, and I had put her away and given her a bill of divorce. In Isaiah 50, verse 1, thus says the Eternal, Where is the bill of your mother's divorcement, whom I have put away? There's the citation that says, hey, listen, I gave you suckers a bill of divorce. We're done. We're throughs. So God was polygamous, number one. Number two, he's divorced. Number three, he's been killed. Number four, he's pictured as a young nobleman who's coming back to marry the church, a virgin church, one that's made up of 10 virgins. Five of them he's going to marry and five of them he isn't. So he's going to practice polygamy once again. Now, we covered this thing of put away and divorce in Matthew 5, 31 and 32. You ought to go to Matthew 5, 32, underline the word divorce, and then put the word put away there so that it reads, but I say unto you that whosoever shall put away his wife, saving for the cause of fornication, causes her to commit adultery, and whosoever shall marry her that is put away commits adultery. You're not committing adultery if you marry somebody that's divorced, as long as the divorce is accompanied with a bill of divorce. So let me say this. Oftentimes, students will come here to school who have been divorced. Remember, they have a pagan civil law marriage, and then they will get a pagan civil law divorce. Well, as we already saw, God does not recognize these pagan marriages, these illegal marriages, nor does he recognize illegal divorces. You have to dot the I's and cross the T's. It's fairly simple. So if you've been divorced, you need to write up a bill of divorce and put it in your ex-spouse's hands. Doesn't take much to do that. Just write up a bill of divorce. You entitle the document Bill of Divorce. Go through these statutes and then you say in the document, it's my intention to divorce you. Here's your bill of divorce pursuant to Deuteronomy 24, verses 1 through 4, and there's another one over here in 1 Corinthians. Let me see if I can find that. Matthew 5, verses 31, 32, and then there's a citation here in Corinthians, I'm pretty sure. Hang on a minute. Yeah, it is. 1 Corinthians 7:15. So you should cite these three scriptures in your bill of divorce. It's 1 Corinthians 7:15, Deuteronomy 24, 1 through 4. And Matthew 5, verses 31 and 32. Now, there's a correction over here that we ought to look at. In Luke 16, verse 18, here's the way this Matthew 5:32 was translated by the King James translators from Luke 16, 18, where it says, whosoever puts away his wife and marries another commits adultery. Whosoever marries her that is put away from her husband commits adultery. When you put somebody away, you don't give them a bill of divorce. The only grounds for putting somebody away is for the cause of fornication. The amount of time between the wedding night and the putting away should not be long after sunrise the following day. You should take the young woman back to her father, demand your money back, so that laches doesn't overtake you, and declare plainly, I'm putting this woman away for fornication. No tokens. Now, I mentioned to you that a female can divorce her husband. Where do we get such authority? Two sources. First, a female has to be treated under the same law as the males. And that's because God has said there's one law in Israel for the homeborn as well as the stranger. Now, a homeborn Israelite woman is indeed a homeborn with all of the rights, all of the immunities, all of the privileges, all of the benefits that the law has to confer upon men. no exceptions. Specifically, in the law, there are prohibitions. Where a prohibition applies to a male or a prohibition applies to a female, there are no rights, privileges, or immunities for you to take advantage of. So, the law says that you're not to add to the law and you're not to take away from the law. That's Deuteronomy 4, verse 2, and Deuteronomy 12, verse 32. The law specifically prohibits women from participating in the priesthood. Women cannot be preachers. But listen, ladies, don't feel bad. I can't be a preacher either. I'm not a Levite. In fact, there's only one tribe that can be preachers. The only women that actually have a complaint against God for discrimination is Levitical women. Women who are descended from Levi, those that belong to the tribe of Levi, might actually stand up in front of the judgment seat and say, listen, you gave these benefits to our Levite men, and you denied them to us. That's not one law for the stranger and the homeborn. That's two laws, one for women and one for men. No other tribe would have that claim. And I'm afraid that you're collaterally estopped because God Himself makes the law and there isn't any appeal. Your appeal on the Day of Atonement goes to the Holy of Holies and God will construe the law. Once He's construed the law, He says, I'm the same yesterday, today, and forever. Tain't changing. It's already been set in cement. Tain't going to happen. Conversely, we men find that women aren't responsible for their debts, but men are. And boys, you can say, well, that's a discriminatory policy against men, and it's unfair. That may be. But the God of Abraham is the only game in town. This is the guy that makes the rules, and you can abide by them, or you can violate them. The choice is yours. But there's no such thing as a broken law without a penalty. Now, in Mark 10, verses 1 through 12, there's a little story here. He arose from thence and came into the coast of Judea by the farther side of Jordan. That's the Jordan River. And the people resorted unto him again. And as he was wont, he taught them again. And the Pharisees came to him and they asked him, is it lawful for a man to put away his wife? They were tempting him. They were putting a legal question before him, using the words put away, so that they could entangle him in his speech, take him into trial, and condemn him and punish him. So he answered and said unto them, well, what did Moses command you? And they said, well, Moses suffered to write a bill of divorcement and to put her away. So Jesus answered and said to them, for the hardness of your heart He wrote you this precept. But from the beginning of the creation, God made them male and female, and for this cause shall a man leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife, and they twain shall be one flesh. So then they are no more twain, but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let not man put asunder. So let me pause right there. And this controversy over gay marriage, very plain. Mark 10, one man, one woman, joined together. God joins them together, they become one flesh. God doesn't join men together, God doesn't join women together. Now, of course, you guys can go out there and do as you please. And you can do it until the judgment. You can get away with breaking the law until old dad comes unhinged. There is a point in time, at some indefinite time in the future, in which you will not be able to repent. Right now, God has been leaning on us and telling us, straighten up and fly right. So far, all He's got is the finger. Now, He'll continue doing this for a certain time, an indefinite time into the future, but at some point, He's going to come unhinged, and when he does, it'll be too late. And then comes the punishment period. So get ready for it. Shape up or get ready for it. Now he goes on in verse 10, he says, "And in the house his disciples asked him again of the same matter. And he said to them, Whosoever shall put away his wife and marry another commits adultery against her. Now if a woman shall put away her husband and be married to another, she commits adultery." All right, so let's suppose we got a woman. If this woman puts her husband away, she commits adultery, because putting away is where you send your spouse out and you don't give them the written document called the bill of divorce. All right, so let me bring that back to your attention again. If you have a civil law divorce and you went out and remarried, you're living in adultery. So the preachers are probably correct when they say, citing Matthew 5:32, that you went out and you divorced and you remarried and you're committing adultery. They're right, but for all of the wrong reasons. We used to have an associate justice on the Supreme Court, and his name was William O. Douglas. And it was reported that Douglas wrote more dissenting opinions than any other justice in the history of the Supreme Court. And he had a famous line. He said, "We have reached the right conclusion for all of the wrong reasons." Very famous justice, and had a very famous line. "We've reached the right conclusion, but for all of the wrong reasons." So when clergymen say of people who are divorced and remarried that they live in adultery, they're right for all the wrong reasons. When they say, because divorce is prohibited in Matthew 5:32, that's not true. The reason that they are committing adultery is because neither one of them ever put a bill of divorce in the other partner's hands. They relied upon a judge somewhere in the Babylonian mystery religion to divorce them. They married under the civil law. They agreed. They had a contract, a three-party limited general partnership, and then they divorced. And when they divorced, they had a dual jurisdiction marriage. Remember, marriage is an agreement with penetration. You had the agreement and the penetration and made you man and wife under the law of God. You had a marriage license, and you had an agreement with penetration in a three-party contract, and you had a marriage under the laws of Pennsylvania. Then you got a divorce under the laws of Pennsylvania, separated and remarried, and you didn't divorce under the common law. You didn't divorce your spouse with a bill of divorce. And you brought Matthew 5:32 to the fore, and it's probably true, but again, for all of the wrong reasons. So you women there in Mark 10, verse 12, if a woman puts away her husband and be married to another, she commits adultery. That's exactly right, lady. If you put your husband away and you didn't give him a bill of divorce and you went out and remarried, or if he went out and remarried, you either caused him to commit adultery or you committed adultery. And he's probably partly liable, because if you put him away, he could have written you a bill of divorce. So why didn't? So if you've got a mind to obey God and keep His commandments, then you need a bill of divorce. Now there's another story in here in Matthew 19, verses 1 through 9. "And it came to pass that when Jesus had finished these sayings, He departed from Galilee, and He went into the coasts of Judea beyond Jordan. And a multitude followed Him there, and the Pharisees also came in tempting Him, and saying to Him, Is it lawful for a man to put away his wife for every cause? And He answered and said unto them, Have you not read that He which made them at the beginning made them male and female, and said, For this cause shall a man leave father and mother, and shall cleave to his wife, and they twain shall be one flesh. Wherefore there are no more twain, but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let not man put asunder. And they said to him, well then why did Moses command to give a writing of divorcement and put her away? And he said to them, Moses, because of the hardness of your hearts, allowed you to put away your wives, but from the beginning it was not so. And I say unto you that whosoever shall put away his wife, except it be for fornication, and shall marry another, commits adultery. And whosoever marries her, which is put away, does commit adultery. So Matthew 19, verses 1 through 9, corrects the mistake, the mistaken mistranslation made by the King James translators when they inserted the word divorced in Matthew 5:32 instead of put away. The subject matter in Matthew 5:32 should be put away, not divorced. Now there's one more facet or factor that we should keep in mind here, and that is that in a divorce, when we have a custody dispute, we almost invariably see that the child is given to the mother. Well, in 1854, in a case called Hunt versus Hunt, the common law makes this clear. In consideration of the rights and duties of the father in relation to his child, he could not. The case here before cited the People versus Merson, we think, fully recognizes this principle. Judge Brunson there, in addition to what is held to be law on this point by Judge Cowan, says, quote, the opinion of this court has been repeatedly expressed that by the law of the land, the common law, the claims of the father are superior to those of the mother. And he also refers to a former opinion sustaining the same doctrine derived by him in that controversy. This doctrine is maintained by numerous decisions of courts of the highest authority in this country. So when there's a divorce, who gets the children? And the answer is the father gets the children after the age of two. There was a case where Samuel was born from his mother Hannah, in which he was to remain with his mother until he was weaned at age two. Then he was to be given to Eli for the service of the temple. So, in Anglo-Saxon administration, from that date to this, no child should be taken from his mother until age two, whether he's weaned or not. Then he belongs to the father, and the father raises the children. And there's an important reason why this is true, and that is, women bond to their children. Men do not. There are cases where animals, for instance, have been separated from their cubs. A bear will be separated from her cub. She goes ballistic and kills people. A moose separated from her calf pushed a school bus off of an icy road up in Vanderhoof, British Columbia. A woman in an earthquake in Mexico City falls into a crack in the earth. She quickly takes her child off of her back and flings the child out of the hole as the crack is closing up and kills her. A woman runs off of a road into an icy creek. She takes her baby and pushes the baby up into the air pocket in the roof of the car. She drowns, rigor mortis sets in, and she is holding the baby as they recover the baby out of the air pocket an hour or so later. Boys, men don't do that. Women do that. Females do that. Females have a bond with their offspring that men don't have. So God comes along and he says, all right, ladies, if you want to divorce your husband, it's okay by me. But know this, the child remains with the father. Now the reason for that is a woman will take a lot of guff before she will leave her children behind. In 1900, the divorce rate, using that philosophy, using that methodology of law, saw a divorce rate of 0.008 per 100,000 in 1900. Today, it's 67%. Now, the divorce rate has gone up dramatically because women today can say, "Charlie, kiss off, you're out of here, and I'm keeping the kids." And that's because today in America we practice matriarchal family instead of patriarchal family. That's the bottom line. Now, this thing called matriarchal family is an offshoot of a middle, you know, the middle age time when the origin and doctrine of parens patriae and the law can be traced to medieval and late medieval English chancery courts, where it played an important role in maintaining the structure of feudalism. And now we have returned to feudalism. Chancery, as an agent of the monarchy, had a duty to assure the orderly transfer of feudal duties from one generation to another, and to ensure that there would be someone available to perform those duties, and the concept of parens patriae was usually invoked in connection with the problems of property or guardianship. And when we look at a feud, it's land held of a superior or condition of rendering him services. It's a hereditary right to use lands, rendering services, therefore, to the Lord, while the property in the land itself remains in the Lord. That's why you pay a property tax, boys and girls, because you practice feudal serfdom. And the marriage license and the return to the doctrine of parens patriae. In place of patriarchal family, you practice matriarchal family. Today, when you divorce, it's the state, the superior lord, who owns the land and owns the child. In some of the colonial statutes, we can see the beginnings of the idea that children are to be protected not only from poverty, but also from parents who are undeserving. And Lord Redesdale maintained that parents have rights to their children only as a privilege granted by the state, and that the state delegates control over children to their parents as a trust, and that it does so because parents discharge this trust faithfully on behalf of their children. But bear in mind, boys and girls, it's a trust relationship in which the state owns your children, because this is feudal tenure and title. Feudal, not allodial. And we're practicing the Babylonian mystery religion. So don't complain about social lady or complain about alimony and child support. All right, we're done. We need to remind you that you've been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, and that the Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and worldwide over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. Now, the Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. Out of time. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So, until then, thanks for listening, and good night, friends.